Totally 80s.
So now I'm obsessed with time. Come on, tell me about the time. Had it all in my head tonight. Had the time of my life. When the words all come down, like this on Tuesday's gone down. Throw it all away.
Welcome to another episode of American Timelines. I'm Amy.
And I am
Joe.
Dabney Coleman's neighbor, Phil.
No, that's Joe.
I collect soup cans.
And this is the podcast where you can get all your 1980s nostalgia.
Yes. Pop culture.
Remembering.
True crime. Songs. Movies. Everything.
Yep, everything like that.
Maybe too much. Maybe we talk about too many things. I don't know. We haven't figured that out.
That's true.
This is episode...
Something.
I have no idea what episode this is now.
Yep.
Because there's so many.
This is the second half of 1985.
The second half of 1985.
And
this is episode...
19.
And I will insert the number.
I was in the midst of talking about Richard Ramirez, The Night Stalker, and we were in the middle of the year, so Joe's going to start us off with a few little tidbits.
Right, and if you remember, just a quick recap of what Richard has done.
He's just been raping and pillaging and murdering throughout California.
And random, like sometimes he shoots people, sometimes he gouges their eyes out.
Sometimes he stabs them.
He left two old women to lay beaten and raped and tortured for 3 days.
Carves pentagrams all over everything.
Pentagrams on people. Like he's had a messed up childhood. Yes, he's a messed up dude.
The devil.
And he's just, and nobody, and it's all over the place too. It's different cities and counties, and it's all really just California. Awful. But nobody knows that it's him yet.
That's right.
But, and we just finished with Back to the Future, and then, Studio, and then we had New Coke, and then we had Coke Classic came out, and then Saturday, July 13th, we had a new number one song from, this is a song from a James Bond movie, Duran Duran, A View to a Kill. Do you remember that song?
Sort of.
John Taylor, bassist John Taylor of Duran Duran, approached the producer of this James Bond movie, Cubby Broccoli.
Mm-hmm. Cubby Broccoli?
Cubby Broccoli is his name, yeah.
Oh my God.
He approached producer Cubby Broccoli at a party and somewhat drunkenly asked, when are you going to get someone decent to do one of your theme songs? This inauspicious...
That's a terrible English
that's
accent.
A terrible accent. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
This inauspicious... Hi, matey. No, that's Australian.
You're a pirate now?
When are you going to get someone decent to do one of your theme songs?
Oh, God, that was awful.
Is that better?
No, that was terrible.
That's British. That sounds British. This inauspicious meeting led to some serious talks, and the band was introduced to Bond composer John Barry and also Jonathan Elias.
Okay.
And so there you go. And the first couple times they got together to record the song, everyone got drunk instead of composing.
Okay.
But that song, you know that song, right? Duran Duran, A View to a Kill. I'm going to sing it a little bit.
I do probably know.
It's killing me because it doesn't, they never say that those words, I don't think. It's like a song that, number one, I never knew was.
It's not Rio or anything like that.
No, it's not Rio, but you know the song, but I don't think I ever knew what they were saying or what they were even singing about, because Duran Duran's on.
Oh, The Union of the Snake or something? They all sound the same.
They do.
It's such bad music. God, Duran Duran, like, almost gives me a stomachache because it's so 80s.
So 80s. Into the fire. It's on me.
Oh, yeah.
Into the fire.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't remember this ever being that popular.
No, I know.
Being number one. You know, I kind of remember that song, but Hungry Like the Wolf was like the shit.
Much more popular.
Oh, I was in love with the woman in that video, Hungry Like the Wolf. I don't know why. Anyway, that song became number one. And then Saturday, July 13th, Live Aid.
Yep.
And this was the day, it was Live Aid. Now, I remember for sure. This is when Bob Dylan pissed everybody off.
Oh, okay.
By saying, telling people, oh yeah, this is Live Aid, is for Africa and the famine, but
America,
but our farmers need some help too, so maybe someday we could do something for them. And a lot of people got pissed off at him then, but then that led to Farm Aid.
Yeah.
So boom, Friday, July 19th, 1985, billed as a top free agent in pro wrestling, Randy Savage. Randy the Macho Man had his first appearance on Tuesday Night Titans, and it featured several established managers. Bobby Heenan, Jimmy Hart, Classy Freddie Blassie.
We're just going to have Randy Savage history throughout the decade.
Yes, we are. Yep. And they were all offering their services to Macho Man because he didn't have a manager.
Sexual services?
No. Management. Okay. So they're like, we're going to take you to the top because he didn't have a manager.
Oh.
You're like, we can tell you're awesome. Yeah. And they would come out to the ring while he was wrestling and all like try to woo him and he would show off for all these managers. They're all offering him money. But he eventually declined all of their offers and he chose his new manager, Miss Elizabeth.
Oh, was she really his manager?
Yeah, it was his wife. And then it was his manager. But his gimmick was a crazed, egomaniacal bully who mistreated Miss Elizabeth and threatened anyone who even looked at her.
Okay.
But a lot of wrestlers said he really was kind of like that. Like
he
would put her in a room by herself and you're not allowed to go in there, not allowed to talk to her and stuff like that.
Oh.
He met her at a gym. She was like a receptionist or something at a gym, and that's where he first met her. And then he married her, and he just decided to take her on the road with him.
Yeah.
Macho Man Randy Savage. So anyway, all these managers were trying to woo him on Tuesday Night Titans, but it was actually on a Friday. It was stupid. Saturday, July 27th, 1985.
Wait a minute, I got something on July 26th.
Oh, July 26th. What is it, baby?
Yes, Tim Burton's directorial debut and Danny Elfman's film scoring debut happened on the same film.
Whoa.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Big Adventure.
Jan Hooks improvised all the dialogue for her scene as the Alamo tour guide.
Oh, she was great.
She was.
There's no basement in the Alamo.
During the entire time Large Marge tells her story, she never blinks.
Oh,
and
really?
The dinosaurs in the film are an actual tourist attraction located at the Wheel Inn restaurant in Cabazon, California, near Palm Springs.
Oh, really? I bet everybody goes there and just says, oh, Pee-wee's.
Yep. So
that's awesome.
What did you have on the 27th?
July 27th. It was a Saturday, and there was a new number one single, Paul Young. You know who Paul Young is? Remember him?
No.
Every time you go
away,
you take a piece of me with you. Every time you go away.
What else?
You take one of my turds with you, a piece of my poop. It's a song written and composed by Daryl Hall.
Boy, no wonder.
Yeah, it sounds like a Daryl Hall song. Mm-hmm. And it was first recorded by Hall & Oates, but they didn't release it as a single. August 3rd, 1985, Tears for Fears.
Shout.
Let it all out. These are things I can do without.
Were they Tears for Fears we already talked about, right?
Talking to you. Stop. Yeah, we talked about them because I ridiculed you for thinking that this song was number one.
And what was June. The other one? But it was a Tears for Fears song, right?
It was.
Okay. So at least I had the artist right.
Yeah, right.
It was a good guess.
Well, right, because it became
It was a month later.
It was a month later. Yeah. That's why it's funny that I ridiculed you for thinking it was June and not July. Duh.
Well, you're just an asshole.
No, I was just... It's called teaching lessons, honey.
It's
this
not.
Is what how you teach a lesson.
You're a dick.
Anyway, it's about... That song's about Primal Scream Theory.
Okay.
Saturday, August 17th, there was a rerun of T.J. Hooker on TV.
Okay.
And Hormel workers went on strike at the Hormel headquarters in Austin, Minnesota. And you know what Hormel makes, right?
Chili?
Spam.
Oh.
They're the makers of canned Spam.
Okay. They make chili, too.
Hormel chili, they do, right.
Okay, so Richard Ramirez,
all the Spam guys are
traveling striking. In his... whirlwind of mayhem everywhere.
Murdering everybody and raping people.
The relentless media and police pressure, aided with the description from his surviving victims, forced Ramirez to leave the L.A. area that August. He journeyed north to San Francisco, where he took two more victims, Peter and Barbara Pan.
No.
Yep.
Shut up.
Nope.
Peter Pan,
yep.
Ma Bell, and Peter Pan.
These are the names, I'm telling you.
Is this all fake?
On August 17th.
Somebody's name was Peter Pan?
Yes. They were Asian, so now you feel bad.
Why would I feel more bad that they're Asian?
Because the last name's Pan. That's obviously an Asian name.
It is?
Yeah.
Peter Pan?
Yes, it's an Asian name.
If your name is Pan, why would you go by Peter?
Well, he probably didn't pick his name, but especially if they're Asian, maybe they don't have that story over there or something.
Like, maybe they've never heard of Peter Pan.
Maybe, you don't know.
And maybe every fucking day someone's like, hey, fucking Peter Pan.
Anyway, so his unmistakable MO, complete with the satanic symbolism, meant that the Valley Intruder moniker was no longer applicable. That's what they first called him.
They initially
called him the Valley Intruder, but
right.
they said that was not anymore
applicable. Can't call him that anymore because
so
why?
The press quickly coined a new name, the Night Stalker, as most of his assaults took place at the night in his victim's home.
He's probably excited because now I'm just a Valley Intruder, now I'm the Night Stalker. August 23rd.
Okay.
Teen Wolf.
Oh.
Came out the same year as Back to the Future, and Michael J. Fox did not like Teen Wolf at all. He hates it to this day and thinks it was garbage, which makes me not like Michael J. Fox because I love Teen Wolf, and Teen Wolf is great. I actually watched it today.
I know you did.
And I watched it today because I looked up this info, and it said that when Scott sings the final shot at the end of the movie, he goes into the stands and hugs his father, immediately behind Michael J. Fox and James Hampton. An extra in a red sweater can be seen with an unzipped fly.
Really?
And this incident, it later resulted in an internet rumor that it's a man exposing himself. But if you look at the full frame version, I show the kids, it's a girl. It's a young woman. Apparently, her pants were too tight, so she unbuttoned and unzipped them, so she'd sit down in the bleachers. And it's just at the top. You can only see her from the waist down. You see this person's pants wide open, then you see her like put her sweater down, then you see her zip it up. Like
really?
Yeah. It's like
it's bizarre. It's
yeah. So I watched that, and they also say that when he makes after he makes the game winning shot, there's a crowd shot, and Emilio Estevez can be seen in front of Boof, his girlfriend.
Is it?
And so I watched for that's what I really watched for. Yeah. Like, there's no fucking way Emilio Estevez is just hanging out as an extra in that show. But I thought, maybe he and Michael J. Fox are friends and he was there. And I watched it like 25 times.
You can't see him.
I think it's a guy that looks kind of like Emilio Estevez, but I don't think it's him.
No.
There's one, because there's like two frames that you can see this guy. One, he's like standing there, or he's got his arms up in the air, and the next he's running down because they all run down to the court.
And you literally spent your time watching this for 25 times.
I spent a lot of time today watching that. Audrey was getting mad. Like, just
finish
the movie.
I bet she was.
But I think there is one of the frames he looks kind of like Emilio Estevez, but the other one, he's clearly not Emilio Estevez.
Okay.
He's way bigger, and he's not. He kind of looks a little bit like him. He makes a face look like him, but he's not. I don't think this is true. I think IMDb is wrong, and I'm going to sue them.
Yeah, might as well.
But, that was August 23rd that came out. Oh, and I just, because we're talking about Teen Wolf, I'm just going to say a line from that. It's Coach Finstock, because I use this. So this is the advice I give to my kids all the time, and people on the street who want advice, because he gives great advice to Scott. He says, Scott's like having all this trouble. What should I do? I'm losing my friends. I don't know what to do. I can't get a girl. And he says, well, let me give you some advice. There are three rules that I live by. Never get less than 12 hours sleep. Never play cards with a guy who has the same first name as the city, and never get involved with a woman with a tattoo of a dagger on her body. Now, you stick to that, everything else is cream cheese.
Okay.
That's great advice. I tell the kids that all the time. What do you mean? And then on Saturday, August 24th, there was a rerun of Airwolf on TV.
So, his actions on his final night of terror on August 24th, 1985, soon led to his capture.
That's his final night?
His final
the same night that The Power of Love by Huey Lewis came number one.
First, he was spotted outside a Mission Viejo home where he unwittingly left another footprint before the witness took note of his car and before a witness took note of his car and license plate. So this young kid saw him and got his license plate.
But how did they know it was him?
Well, the police...
They had a description?
Yeah.
And they saw a footprint?
Later, after Ramirez raped another woman at her home and shot her fiancé, the victim provided a detailed description of her assailant who had forced her to swear her love for Satan.
Whoa. So he didn't kill her.
No,
he raped her, killed the husband.
Yeah.
Tell me you love Satan.
Yes, he did it.
Tell me you love Satan.
Major.
I don't really love him, though. Commit to Satan now.
So his abandoned car was found a few days later, complete with enough of a fingerprint to make a match, and his criminal record enabled the police to finally put a name to the Night Stalker.
They finally got the Night Stalker's name.
So he...
And the Valley Killer...
National TV and print media coverage featuring his prison photo, along with a series of clues from witnesses and survivors, starts up. And he goes to Arizona to visit his brother. And
not knowing any of this is on the TV?
Yeah. He goes to Arizona to visit his brother, and while he's gone, they find out his name. And they plaster his face on the front of all the newspapers.
Everywhere.
And he's not in town, so he has no idea.
He has no idea that it's about to come to a... weekend.
Yeah. So then he comes back into L.A. and he gets off the in the bus. He's at the bus station.
Yeah.
And there's police at the bus station, but they're expecting to see somebody get on the bus to take to leave.
Yeah, they not don't to expect come off the bus arriving.
Right. So, so they don't notice him.
They just don't because they're watching for people trying to leave. They're not even seeing him.
And
slip
so
back
then
in.
He goes to this.
That's crazy.
Then he goes into this store. And he notices that people are staring at him in the store.
Everybody's like, holy shit, that's and a fucking guy that's everywhere.
He gets something, and he notices he sees his face on the newspaper.
Oh,
and then he hears these women, these like Spanish women were standing in the back of the store, and they start pointing at him and going, El Matador, which is the killer.
That means the killer?
Yeah.
El Matador means the killer?
Yeah. And
all
so they're
time?
Pointing at him.
Tito Santana was the killer, huh?
They're saying that. And,
El Matador. El Matador.
So he takes off running and starts hopping fences in the neighborhoods. He tries to steal a car three different times.
Boom. And he can't because
everybody's
are just
starting
pointing
to
at him.
They're starting to chase him.
There's everyone.
So his mob.
Citizens are just chasing him.
Start chasing him. And they're chasing
what?
Him through neighborhoods
this
and
is like
backyards.
A movie.
It is. And so then they catch him and they beat the shit out of him.
What?
Yeah,
beat the shit out of that dude.
He ran across before they got him, he ran across a freeway and got onto a bus.
Beat his ass.
He gets on the bus and slowly everybody in the bus starts pointing at him.
Wait, he got away from the mob that was beating the shit out of him.
They before they started beating him, they're chasing him and he ran across the highway.
Yeah.
Got on a bus. And he gets on the bus and he's like probably out of breath and panting and everything and then people start everybody's
like, hey,
staring at him and they're
no,
they stand up and start pointing at him.
Uh-uh, bro.
So then he gets off the bus. And he tries to steal this woman's car, but her husband comes around and starts beating the shit out of him. And then all the rest of the mob catches up and everybody's beating him up. And the police finally get there. They have to, like, protect him from this angry mob that is, like, ready to kill him. Yeah. So he waited in jail as his trial was continuously pushed off. The delay was marked by a series of motions and bickering between the prosecutors and defense attorney.
Man.
And they had to... Some of his charges were dropped in order to expedite what was becoming a long jury to justice because of all of this stuff. So jury selection process finally moves forward on July 22nd, 1988, and the trial itself commenced the following January. During this time, Ramirez attracted a cult-like following of supporters, many of whom wore black-clad Satan worshippers. Ramirez himself often dressed in black along with dark sunglasses for his courtroom appearances, and he had all these women...
That liked him?
That were big groupies, yes.
That's so weird.
Yet another delay occurred when one juror was found murdered on August 14th, 1989, but rumors that Ramirez had orchestrated her death proved unfounded.
That's the same day that the Sega Genesis was released.
Yep. On September 20th, 1989, the jury finally reached a unanimous guilty verdict on 43 charges, including 13 counts of murder, 5 counts of attempted murder, 11 sexual assault charges, and 14 burglary charges.
Dang.
That's 2 weeks later, the same jury recommended the death sentence on 19 counts. Leaving the courtroom, Ramirez responded, "Hey, big deal. Death always comes with the territory. I'll see you in Disneyland."
That was his last, that's what he said?
The convicted murderer was formally sentenced to death in the gas chamber. On November 7th, 1989, he was sentenced to San Quentin Prison in California to spend the remainder of his days.
On what day?
November 7th, 1989.
That's that same night... The television show Chicken Soup was on with Jackie Mason and Lynn Redgrave.
While he was incarcerated, Ramirez married one of his supporters, 41-year-old Doreen Leoy, in 1996.
What's wrong with that lady?
His long-awaited appeal finally made it to the California Supreme Court in 2006 before being rejected. Ramirez eventually was linked to more vicious crimes. In 2009, a DNA sample connected him with the April 10th rape and murder of a 9-year-old girl in San Francisco. After nearly 24
fucking
years
kill that,
on
bro.
Death row, Richard Ramirez died on June 7th, 2013, at the age of 53, from complications related to B-cell lymphoma. According to San Quentin Corrections officers, his death came shortly after he was taken to the hospital. So that is pretty much the story of the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez.
I can't believe all those people beating the shit out of him didn't kill him.
I know.
You know
I
what
love
mean?
That. I hit that whole. I can imagine that whole
I would just
scene
love
of his capture.
I'd love to be helping them beat the shit
yes,
out of him.
Yes, absolutely.
Especially after you told me the 9-year-old girl part. But just watching all those people just band together.
I mean, it was a community.
Like, yeah, it was
they
just
were
like,
taking their community back.
Yeah, they were all
they
like,
were terrorized
no,
by him.
You can't be here.
Yep.
You don't belong here. Yeah. You can't do that shit to us.
Yeah,
we're Americans.
It's like vigilante.
We're Americans, just, motherfucker. We love Randy Macho Man Savage, and we love Mr. T and WrestleMania, and you can't do that shit. We're gonna watch Back to the Future and Teen Wolf, and
that's right.
You can't watch it.
That's right.
Go to jail, biatch. Saturday, September 7th.
Yeah.
A new number one song on the Billboard charts, John Parr. You know who that is?
Sort of.
I didn't know who he was. St. Elmo's Fire?
Oh, I was going to say, I thought it was a composer.
Motion. Yeah. St. Elmo's Fire.
Yuck.
Did you know that the song was originally written by David Foster and John Parr for the Canadian athlete Rick Hansen?
No.
Who at the time was going around the world in his wheelchair to raise awareness for spinal cord injuries.
Okay.
His journey was called the Man in Motion Tour.
Oh.
Yeah. So there you go.
There you go.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday, September 14th, the Golden Girls pilot aired. Dorothy, Rose, and Blanche are three women who share a house in Miami, Florida.
Yes, they
Dorothy's
do.
Dorothy's elderly mother, Sophia, unexpectedly moves in after her retirement home burns down, and Blanche accepts a proposal of marriage and then ends up banging every dude in Miami.
That's right.
Blanche was a slut.
She was.
She banged everybody, every rich way.
I feel like you edited that a little bit.
No, I didn't. She has had so much sex. Everyone has had sex with Blanche. Rue McClanahan is good to go. All right, now boom. Did you know that Rue McClanahan was originally going to play Rose and Betty White was going to play Blanche originally?
Really?
Because that's their characters from other shows, like Betty White's always a whore and Rue McClanahan's always a dummy.
Yeah.
And they decided for fun they wanted to switch it up. Like, I want to try to be dumb and I want to try to be a whore. Because Betty White was always gorgeous.
Yeah,
beautiful.
She is,
she was always the sexy sex slut one. So they switched it up and they were both
funny.
Brilliant.
Yeah, they were.
Did you know that?
Nope.
Wednesday, September 18th, David Letterman's first top 10 list appeared.
Oh, that late?
That late.
I thought he did it throughout the 80s.
No, it didn't start till 85.
Okay.
And his first top 10 list, do you want to know what it was?
What was it?
It's not great. The top 10 words that almost rhyme with peas.
Oh, that was it?
And it's 10. Heats.
Oh, because it
Number 9.
Rhymes.
Rice.
Oh.
Number 8. Moss. Number 7.
You're going to read all 10 of them?
Number 6. Needs.
Yeah.
Number 5. Lens.
That doesn't even almost rhyme with peas.
Number 4, ice. Almost rhymes with peas. Number 3, nurse.
This is what went for comedy in 1985?
Yes. Number 2, leaks. And the number 1 word that almost rhymes with peas, meats.
That just
it's so stupid that funny. It's almost... meats is always... He always loved meats.
Meats.
He always loved talking about meats. But... Yeah, that
put
was
a plural on it.
I don't get like that really wasn't
that.
Clever. I can't believe that turned into a nightly.
I know, right?
Because that was the first one was not that good.
Nope.
September 21st, 1985. Dire Straits take over the number one Billboard charts with
"Money for Nothing" and "Your Chicks for Free."
I want my
MTV.
Did you know that's that part is the same sound as. Don't stand so.
Oh, it is. That's true.
So close to me.
How'd you figure that out?
Sting. That's Sting that sings it. You know.
Oh,
that, right?
He sings "I Want My MTV."
I want my.
Oh.
And he also sings on the hook
on
that song. He sings the background. He sings
easy money for nothing. They what do they say?
He sings.
We can get some microwave ovens. Custom kitchen
delivery. We gotta move these
refrigerators.
We gotta move these color TVs.
Look at that.
Dun, and he sings the part that goes. There's a part in there that he sings. Money for nothing.
Yeah.
Money for nothing and the chicks.
I didn't know that was Sting.
Yeah, that's Sting that sings the background in that too. And that remember how groundbreaking that video was? I mean, our kids watch it too. They're like, "That was high tech back then." Like,
that's
it's
right.
Because he jumps the computer animated guy jumps into the TV into the video. But the cool thing about this, the song's lyrics are written from the point of view of two working class men watching music videos and commenting on what they see.
Yeah.
And the song features a guest appearance by Sting, singing background vocals.
Mm-hmm.
Both the introduction of "I Want My MTV" and. That other part you can hear. You can tell it's him.
Yeah.
But the lead guy is the guy who works in a hardware department in television, custom kitchen, refrigerator, microwave, appliance store, singing the song. And Mark Knopfler, Mark mm-hmm. Knopfler, who wrote the song, he said, I actually wrote the song when I was in a store. I had to borrow a piece of paper and write it down right then because I wanted to use the language that the guy was actually saying because it was more real. And they actually heard this guy.
Yeah.
And they were in a department store with all the TVs.
They got to move these color TVs.
And they had all these TVs on, and it was switched to MTV. And Motley Crue, actually Tommy Lee mentioned that he thinks that song's about Motley Crue because they were on the MTV. There was a Motley Crue video because they talk about, look at that faggot on the MTV. And they say, that little faggot gonna be a millionaire.
Yeah.
And they say that, and then it goes...
Motley Crue thinks that's about them.
Yeah, he said it was about them, and it probably was because they're saying, as they were standing there at this store, they hear this repair guy, these TV guys, saying, the guy was wearing a baseball cap, work boots, and a checkered shirt, delivering boxes, and he's watching MTV, and he remembers the man saying things like, what are those Hawaiian noises? That ain't working. That's the way you do. That ain't working. And then he said, he was writing him down, and he heard the guy saying, oh, man, look at that guy banging bongos like a chimpanzee. He describes a singer as that little faggot with the earring and the makeup. Mm-hmm. And he bemoans that these artists, they get money for nothing and chicks for free. And, Nikki Sixx was the one who said the song was about Motley Crue's outrageous lifestyle because they wore makeup.
Yeah.
And he's like, look at this faggot with an earring and a makeup. Yeah, mm-hmm. And so he actually says that in the song. The
little faggot with the
same TV.
Yeah.
Which that's a pretty good song, though, still. I still didn't even play that loud. Thursday, October 10th. Another top show aired one of their special events, Cosby Show, had a happy anniversary. Yeah, it's terrible now because he was raping people probably during the filming of this. But this was a big Cosby Show when it was Russell and Anna Huxtable's anniversary. And so the Huxtables do a big song and dance, and they do a whole song. They perform Ray Charles, Nighttime is the Right Time.
Oh.
You never watched Cosby Show, right?
I did some,
they did this whole video where they all came down the steps singing, and they all sang.
I wonder if he ever assaulted Felicia Rashad.
I don't think she did, because Ahmad Rashad would have beat the fucking shit out of
him. Oh, he was a football player, wasn't he?
Yeah, for the Vikings, the greatest team ever. But she stood by him kind of through a lot of this stuff.
I wonder.
She never did, But, they had to know. Everybody had to know.
I know,
Oh, it's terrible.
I wonder if he did anything with Lisa Bonet.
Well, there was controversy there. Remember, she pissed him off by
really
being nude in movies or something. But I don't know if there was anything like that. But anyway, that episode, they all sing that Ray Charles song, and it's real funny because Rudy sings the really
baby. I remember that now. I do remember that.
That was really funny, and everyone loved that. Like, that was a huge big thing. But rape ruined it.
Yes.
Thursday, October 10th, the death of Yul Brynner. He died of lung cancer.
Yep, I remember that.
And after his death, there was a commercial that aired
with him on it saying, don't smoke.
Now that I'm gone, I tell you, don't smoke. Whatever you do, just don't smoke. Saturday, October 12th. A new number one song. Oh, Sheila.
Yeah.
Oh, Sheila.
Who sings that?
I was going to ask you. Do you know who sings that?
Oh. It's like, no, I don't.
I will admit, I always thought it was Prince.
Yeah, it sounds like Prince.
It does sound like Prince. It's a complete knockoff of Prince.
Yeah.
It's a group called Ready for the World.
Oh.
And the song is very commonly misattributed to Prince.
Yeah. Because of Sheila.
And I think because of Sheila E. And all that.
Yeah.
And I'll admit, I really think I thought that was him this whole time.
Yeah. Total ripoff, though.
It's a ripoff, yeah. Ready for the World is an American R&B band from Flint, Michigan. And that the lead singer kind of looks and dresses like Prince.
Oh, so it's totally a ripoff.
So it's kind of Prince, yeah.
Yeah.
At least, in the video, on the album cover, anyway. October 19th, Ready for the World has overtaken by A-ha.
Oh.
And they had a groundbreaking video.
Yeah, I remember it.
Remember this?
Yes.
Remember the video?
Yep, it was like a drawing. They went into the comic book, and it was...
Yeah, he pulls the girl into the comic book and falls in love with her.
I can't remember the name of the song, though.
Take
on me. That's
on
right.
Me.
Yep.
Take
who sings that
on
again?
Me. Aha. That's right. Yeah, and it was a really good video. I watched it recently. I made the kids watch it, and they thought it was cool.
I'm confused with the Tears for Fears. I get Tears for Fears and Aha.
Yeah, I could see, because I can't name anything else Aha sang. Can you?
Yeah, no. Nope.
They're a Norwegian synth pop band.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good. That's a pretty good video. I mean, it really definitely.
Yeah.
Pretty much holds up. Boom. How about that?
Yep.
Saturday, October 26th. Aha, Take on Me is overtaken by Whitney Houston.
I Want to Dance with Somebody or something.
Saving all my love for you. It's written by Michael Masser and Gary Goffin.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally a minor hit for Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis in 1978.
Yes, Marilyn McCoo.
And so this is a redo, which I didn't realize it was a redo.
Yeah.
So boom. How do you know, like, you're familiar with Marilyn McCoo?
She was on Solid Gold.
Oh God.
She was one of the MCs of Solid Gold.
Really?
Yep.
That's funny.
Mm-hmm.
Sunday, or as the old people say, Sunday,
mm-hmm.
the very next day after that became number one, the 1985 World Series ended. American League champions Kansas City Royals played the NL champions St. Louis Cardinals and won the series in 7 games. It was popularly known as the Show Me Series or the I-70 Showdown Series, as both cities are in the state of Missouri are connected by Interstate 70.
Yep.
You know who the MVP was?
Nope.
Brett Saberhagen.
Oh, no.
Saberhagen married his high school sweetheart, Janine Inglet, in 1984. But that marriage and a second marriage ended in divorce, proving once and for all that there's nothing to look forward to in life.
Who cares?
If Brett Saberhagen cannot have a successful 2 marriages,
honey,
why should we try?
All right, what's next?
This marriage is not going to last. Brett Saberhagen's didn't. Friday, November 1st, 1985, the Enoch Pratt Free Library in Baltimore held a held a youth rap contest.
Yeah.
And the winner of that youth rap contest at the Enoch Pratt Free Library was 14-year-old
Eminem.
Tupac Shakur.
Oh, I thought it was Eminem. I just heard Detroit, and that's what made me think Eminem.
I didn't say Detroit. I said Baltimore.
Oh, okay.
So I'm sorry. I don't know how you heard Detroit when I didn't say Detroit.
Same thing.
That's not the same thing.
I know.
The Enoch Pratt Free Library had the Kerr sponsored a youth rap contest in November 85, and Shakur spotted a flyer that said, "Calling all rappers across the top, urging anyone under the age of 18 to write the best rap about the Pratt Library and be eligible for a cash prize. All entrants had to submit written copy in advance. No profanity allowed. And the finalists performed at the library at Pennsylvania and North Avenues."
Okay.
Shakur and his buddy Smith created Library Rap, which Shakur wrote out in longhand and black pen on a piece of lined notebook paper. And his East Side Crew was the name of their rap group, and they entered the contest. And the lady who put on the thing, she said, "They were very polite boys. They were nice kids. I drove them to the contest because they didn't have transportation." And at the beginning of the rap, Shakur says, "Yo, Enoch Pratt, bust this." And then he urged Baltimoreans to get library cards in that rap. They told kids to stay in school, learn to read, and get all the credits that you need.
Okay.
So anyway, that's how it all started with Tupac. All Eyes on Me. Saturday, November 2nd, 1985, Stevie Wonder takes over the number one spot in the Billboard charts with what? What do you think? Here's a hint. Luther Vandross.
That's What Friends Are For.
Sings background vocals.
No, what was that? What Friends Are For? Was that another Farm Aid?
That's What Friends Are.
Was that another Live Aid or Farm Aid where there's a whole bunch of them singing it?
It was a few of them, but I don't know. I think it was for something, but it was Stevie Wonder and it was Dionne Warwick.
That's right.
And maybe Gladys Knight or something.
Yeah, it could be.
We'll get to that whenever we get to that, but I don't think it was 85.
This isn't it. Okay. Well, I don't know what
this is. This is Part-Time Lover.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, Luther Vandross sings with him. And so does Philip Bailey.
Okay.
Of Earth, Wind, and Fire, who also...
Yeah.
Remember Philip Bailey sang with Phil Collins?
Oh, he did. Okay.
She's an easy love.
Oh, all right.
She gave you
hot,
you know, feeling. Saturday, November 9th, 1985, Robert Downey Jr. became a cast member on Saturday Night Live.
Was he really?
For 1 season.
I was going to say, I never knew that.
Yep. And in this night, Madonna hosted with Simple Minds as the guest, and Robert Downey Jr. played Sean Penn in some kind of wedding video thing. Like, he pretended to be Sean Penn. I can't remember what they were doing. But, Robert Downey Jr. is highly regarded as the worst Saturday Night Live cast member of all time.
Oh, really?
Because this was a time when Lorne Michaels fired. Something about Lorne Michaels left Saturday Night Live and then came back. Like, this is when he came back and he was trying to save it. And he fired everybody. And then he hired all these actors, like these people that weren't comedian people. And
oh.
Robert Downey Jr. is one of them. There's a couple, like Julia Louis-Dreyfus, I think, was around at the time. There's a couple other ones that were on there that didn't last good. Anthony Michael Hall.
That's right.
Yeah. Like, he was an actor. Like, he wasn't a comedian. So there's a few of these people that were just random. They just but Robert Downey Jr. is remembered as the worst.
That's funny.
But he's had a super successful career. So
yeah.
That same night... we got a new number one song.
Okay.
Part-Time Lover. America was done with Part-Time Lover. They're like, you know what? We're not into that. We want a TV theme song to be the number one song.
Oh.
We want just a TV theme song to a show that maybe have guys with suit jackets, white suit jackets with the sleeves rolled up.
Oh, Miami Vice theme song.
Miami Vice theme song, yeah.
It was number one.
It was number one on the Billboard charts, and it was the first...
That's pretty pathetic.
It was the first instrumental to top the Hot 100.
I thought we had Chariots of Fire.
No, I'm sorry. It was the last instrumental to top the Hot 100 until 2013 when Harlem Shake made it.
Oh, Harlem Shake is...
Remember the Harlem Shake? That one with... Harlem Shake is like a... Yeah, it's like it was a viral video for a while. It was a viral thing where people were making these videos where it was like it starts out with just like one or two people, and then pretty soon it's everybody dressed in crazy costumes going crazy. Anyway, so there's that. And then Thursday, November 14th, 1985, a very special episode of Family Ties when Alex hires a 13-year-old tutor, Eugene Forbes.
Is it the girl? No.
Alex hires 13-year-old tutor Eugene Forbes to help him bring his grade up in advanced geometry from 89% to 90%. However, Eugene is immediately distracted when he meets Jennifer, and he struggles to learn how to stop being an intellectual genius and learn to be a 13-year-old kid. Eugene is played by River Phoenix.
Oh.
Yeah.
Boy, that's crazy.
And you know how River Phoenix died later.
Yeah.
He was killed on the set of Family Ties.
No.
No, he wasn't.
No, that didn't happen.
But yeah, River Phoenix was on there.
Oh, boom. Wow.
Saturday, November 16th, 1985.
It's Joy's birthday.
It's Joy's birthday. It's, and she turned.
I don't remember. She was 4 years younger, or 2 years younger than me. So.
Six.
No, she was not
13,
that old.
13, 4, 11, 6.
She's probably like 11 or something.
11. Happy birthday, Joy.
That was it.
Happy birthday to
you. All right.
Okay, Amy's got a friend named Joy, and she's not listening.
No.
She. Doesn't care for Amy anymore.
I'll shout her out, and then maybe she'll listen.
That's what you do.
Yep.
You dedicate everybody. An episode to her, and then she becomes a listener, and then
that's
she gets
right.
hooked. Also, Saturday, November 16th,
yep.
Starship takes over the number one spot on the Billboard charts.
Starship.
Yes. So there's a whole big background I looked up on this, why they became Starship. There was a lawsuit.
Oh, there was.
Between some of the members of the band saying, you can't use Jefferson, and you can't use Airplane.
Oh, so, really?
You know, they were Jefferson Starship.
Or no, they were Jefferson Airplane first.
Then they became...
Jefferson Starship.
Jefferson Starship.
Then they said you can't use Jefferson either?
Yeah, they couldn't use Jefferson or Airplane, so they became just Starship.
Starship.
And
they were crappy by then. Was it, we built this city on rock and roll?
Which is probably one of the greatest songs in American history.
It's an awful song.
We built this city.
Terrible song.
And there's one verse by the guy, and then one verse by Grace Slick.
It's such a
Mickey Thomas
song.
And Grace Slick are the two.
It's like the only one they did is Starship.
Yeah, in this video.
They were good as Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah, they were.
They rocked.
And Starship was the greatest, too.
No.
We built this city on rock and roll. Built this city.
All right, that's bad.
How can you not love that song?
I don't care for it.
You don't like it at all?
No.
Man. Well, in the video, they're, you know, they're in San Francisco in one part of it, and they're in, I think they're in Vegas or somewhere after that.
Because there's a bunch of cities built on rock and roll, apparently.
Yeah, there's more than one city. And one knee deep in the hoopla.
So dumb.
Cooperation games, something like that. Yeah, and knee deep in the hoopla. I just love that lyric when they were singing that. Knee deep in the hoopla. Like, who says that?
I know, it's dumb.
And then that's what they named their album, Knee Deep in the Hoopla.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I'm always knee deep in some hoopla.
No, you're not.
Know what I mean? Monday, November 18th, 1985.
Yes.
Mr. Snuffleupagus
was
revealed to the adults on Sesame Street.
Yeah, I know why.
You do?
Yeah, because he was imaginary and nobody ever believed Big Bird, and they thought that was teaching
kids. Or the
kids.
The kids could see him too, I think, right?
No, I don't think anybody could.
Oh, just Big Bird.
Maybe the kids could.
Big Bird's the only one could
see
him.
But then...
it was so frustrating.
They were worried that they were teaching kids not to tell adults about stuff because they wouldn't be believed.
Yep.
And like, don't tell adults about abuse and stuff because they wouldn't be believed.
Yeah.
So they made it.
That's exactly right. They thought it would make children less likely to hide sexual assault.
That's right.
I remember being incredibly frustrated.
Yes, I was too.
Damn it, he was just there.
Yeah, I know.
Shit, he's real. God dang it, he is this stuff. And then I wasn't watching Sesame Street anymore in 1985, so I was unaware
that everybody
could see him until like I think when we had kids and we were watching. I was like, hey, how the fuck can they see Snuffleupagus all of a sudden?
Yeah.
And then I kind of wondered, was that all just a dream I had? Or was it? It's like the Berenstain Bears thing.
Yeah.
Where people think it's somebody went back in history and changed the way they spelled Berenstain.
Oh, right.
That it wasn't Berenstain or Berenstain.
It was Bernstein.
Berenstain. S-T-A-I-N is how it is, but everybody thought it was Stein.
Yeah, that's right.
So they think there's like an alternate universe.
There's like a Matrix glitch.
Which I also thought was a Snuffleupagus. There's a Snuffleupagus world and a Berenstain world.
That's not true.
No, it is true. We're living in a Matrix. None of this is real.
All right.
Wednesday, November 27th, 1985.
Yeah.
Rocky IV was released.
Which one is that?
The Russian.
Okay.
It's the Russian.
I remember that. I don't think I saw it, but I remember it.
When shooting this film, Sylvester Stallone decided that for the shooting of the fight, he and Dolph Lundgren should hit one another for real so as to increase the intensity of the scene. After doing 3 takes of Rocky taking shots to the ribs, Stallone felt a burning in his chest but ignored it. Later that night, he had difficulty breathing and was taken to a nearby emergency room. It was discovered that his blood pressure was over 200.
Oh.
And he had to be flown on a low-altitude flight from Canada to St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica, where he remained in intensive care for 4 days.
So Dolph Lundgren fucked him up.
Dolph Lundgren had punched him so hard in the chest that his heart had slammed up against his breastbone
and
began to swell, cutting off the blood supply and restricting the oxygen flow throughout the body.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's rough.
Isn't that crazy? I never heard about that. You didn't hear about stuff back then.
No, that's right.
Carl Weathers nearly quit the film when Dolph Lundgren tossed Weathers into the corner of the boxing ring. Weathers shouted profanities at Lundgren while leaving the ring and announcing that he was calling his agent and quitting the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But Sylvester Stallone forced the two actors to reconcile to get the movie to continue. This event caused a 4-day work stoppage while Weathers was talked back into the part, and Lundgren agreed to tone down his aggressiveness.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
All that stuff happened.
Yep.
A lot of testosterone.
Yes.
Boners.
Yes.
Saturday, November.
I don't think they had boners while they were boxing.
Well, that's.
No.
Yeah, they all had boners.
No, they did not.
That's why they were fighting. They're like, hey, stop getting a boner. Boom. Hey, now I got a boner. Stop giving me a boner. Boom.
Is that how it works with boys?
Every time there's a fight,
it's because you both have boners.
Yeah, it's because of a boner. Every time you see a fight.
They both have boners.
Anytime you see anybody fighting.
They both have boners.
Well, think about it. You see two dudes get in a fight, like at a bar, what's the first thing they do? They get right in each other. They like almost kiss.
And then they have boners.
And then they start, and their boners touch, and that's when they start fighting. As soon as the boner touches, that's when somebody starts throwing the punch.
So not.
That's what I'm assuming.
All right.
I haven't been in many fights.
Yeah. Obviously.
I'm assuming that's what happens.
You're just assuming.
That's what I assume happens.
All right.
I mean, what else could it be?
Right, exactly. Yeah, right. That's the only logical explanation.
Yeah. How else could a fight start?
Okay.
Saturday, November 30th.
Yep.
1985. Phil Collins and Marilyn Martin take over the number one charts in the Billboard.
Oh, was it?
Chart system.
Look at me now.
No.
Oh, no.
I don't know who Marilyn Martin is. Do you?
Mm-mm.
I think it's Martin Mull's wife.
No, I don't think that's right.
It probably isn't. Separate Lives.
Oh, yes.
I can't think of how this goes.
Now we're living separate lives. Something like, no, I'm wrong.
Sound right.
I know it's on the tip of my tongue.
Separate Lives.
I know. No, it's...
We are living separate lives.
I can't remember.
Take those separate lives.
No, that's not right.
I know I looked it up, but...
Oh, God, it's on the tip of my tongue.
But Phil Collins is all over the charts.
He was an 80s... Fantastico.
There's, of course, a video. The official video is, Gregory Hines is in it.
Oh, nice.
And he's getting a back rub. Oh, this is from that movie, White Knights.
Yeah,
you ever heard that movie?
Yeah, I think I have heard of it. Oh, yeah. That's right. To ask me how I feel. You have no right to treat me so unkind. I can't go on.
I don't remember that.
On to time. Now that we're living separate lives.
I don't remember that song at all. But Gregory Hines is in the video, but I think it's just scenes from that movie.
Yeah.
Remember when Gregory Hines was everything?
Yep.
Remember
the big tap dancer?
Remember that movie with Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal?
Very vaguely.
It was set in Chicago, and
were they
Billy
like,
Crystal was always wearing a Cubs hat. God, that was Steve Bishop's favorite movie.
I don't remember what it's called, though.
I can't believe, I'm sure we'll talk about it. It must have been 86
that
came out. We'll talk about it hopefully next episode. But anyway, Gregory Hines was everywhere, and now he's just nowhere.
Is he alive still, I wonder?
I don't know.
I think he might be dead.
If you're
I heard he was dead.
If you're listening to this and you attended Gregory Hines' funeral, call in the show tweet us at History of the Jerks.
Because there's no other way for us to find out if he's alive or
dead. We can't find out. There's no way. We can look up every song we want immediately.
There's no
way to find out. We'll just never know until somebody tweets us.
We'll just assume he's dead.
Yeah, we'll just assume he's dead or a zombie. We'll assume he died and then came back to life.
Okay.
Until we hear different. Wednesday. Oh, wait, before we move on, Phil, that song Separate Lives was written by songwriter Stephen Bishop.
Oh.
And he recorded his own version for his album Sleeping with Girls for Polydor Records.
Who cares?
Stephen Bishop. I only wanted to mention that because my best friend is named Steve Bishop, and people get it confused all the time. You think I'm talking
Steve
about...
Steve Bishop, listen?
He doesn't... I don't think he has access
to... doesn't know what a podcast is.
No, he does, but he just doesn't have access to...
the internet.
The internet right now or something.
Oh, okay.
But he said when he gets it back, he's going to listen. He's on a break. He's on a social media break or a universe break or something.
Okay.
He loves cigarettes. Wednesday, December 4th, 1985.
The Jewel of the Nile...
The Jewel...
came out.
...of the Nile.
Romancing the Stone, which was 1984, that was the predecessor of this film.
You know, I don't know that I knew that there was two.
Yeah, it was the only produced screenplay for writer Diane Thomas. She'd been working as a waitress in Malibu when producer star Michael Douglas optioned her script for $250,000, allowing her to quit her job. Sadly, Thomas died in a car accident while working on a new movie project with Steven Spielberg the following year, about 7 weeks before the opening of this film.
Oh,
she was a passenger while her boyfriend was driving in a Porsche that Douglas had bought for her as a thank you gift.
Oh, I'd like
a Porsche.
The
film is dedicated in memory of Thomas.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know about that.
Yep.
There's also Philip Michael Thomas's wife?
No, she was a waitress.
Oh.
In a cocktail bar.
Do you know who Philip Michael Thomas is?
Yes, he was in Miami Vice, I believe.
I was working as a waitress in a cocktail bar.
It took you a minute for that one.
When I met you.
Right,
we covered that song in
I know we
previous
did already.
Episode.
That's right.
But we didn't sing that line from it.
That's true.
I regret not singing that line from it.
I think we might have.
No, we didn't. We sang just the...
Don't you want me.
Right. We didn't sing the cocktail bar part. I was waiting for us to, and I'm just upset that we didn't. Friday, December 6th, 1985, Spies Like Us came out.
I never saw that.
Remember that movie?
Yeah, but I never saw it.
I did. I saw it. My grandma took us to see it. I remember seeing that.
Oh, really?
It was Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd, who rarely worked together on Saturday Night Live, but
they probably didn't get along. Chevy Chase is supposed to be a giant asshole.
He's a big, huge asshole. Everybody hates his guts. And this was again another movie that's supposed to be John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. And John Belushi died. Apparently, there was 800 movies planned for
John Belushi. And
Ghostbusters and Spies Like Us. And I remember reading there's a whole bunch of them. This was supposed to be
John Belushi
again, but he died, so somebody else got it.
Wow.
So really. There's a lot of actors that should thank John Belushi for dying. Comedians, because they got parts.
I guess so.
Chevy Chase is one of them, but he's...
he never will.
He's apparently a dick.
Yeah.
So that's all I had about that. It was supposed to be John Belushi. And then Saturday, December... and it wasn't that good. It was like kind of funny, like some funny parts.
Yeah.
But when you see those two guys from Saturday Night Live, you think it's going to be hilarious.
Yeah.
And it's just... they're spies. And I think you see Dan Aykroyd's wife's boobs in it, maybe. She's like a Russian...
oh, grandma took you to
Russian.
A movie with boobs?
Yeah, I think.
Oh, wow.
I feel like there was boobs and everything. Maybe you didn't see her boobs. Maybe she's just in a bikini or something. But
could be.
Yeah, I think she probably covered our eyes and then probably asked us if we were okay afterwards.
Yeah.
Which my grandma would always... if you were ever in the bathroom for more than 30 seconds,
grandma would
knock on the door and be like, are you okay? Do you need a tempo?
That's got to be irritating. That would be very irritating.
Well, you know what? Now the tables have turned. She's 89 years old.
And she's in the bathroom every five seconds.
Yeah, she goes to the bathroom like every 15 minutes. So we should now
knock on it. Do you need a tempo?
Are you okay?
Are you okay?
Everything okay? Are you okay?
Which I never heard of tempo until I met your grandmother.
Yeah, my grandma loved tempo. It was
must have been a regional
gummy
medication.
It was a gummy stomach soother. It really worked really good, though,
yeah.
I gotta say.
They don't make it here.
Yeah, they don't make it. She still got some. She hoarded it.
From the 80s.
Because she hoarded it, so she still got some. That's why I think she hoards things.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough about my grandma. This is not to be confused with our other podcast, the my 89-year-old grandmother's embarrassing habits.
Yeah.
That'll be released next year.
That's a different podcast.
We're working on that. We only have 17 hours of that recorded right now.
We need a little more of that.
Yeah, a little more of my grandmother's embarrassing habits. Saturday, December 7th, 1985. A new number one single by Mr. Mister.
Oh, was it Sister Christian? No, that was somebody else.
What?
It was somebody else.
What night? That's Night Ranger.
Oh, Bite your tongue. Slap
yourself in the face.
Calm down.
No one misattributes
Night Ranger to Mr. Mister.
Sister Christian on my podcast.
All right.
No one misattributes.
Stop. Calm it down.
No one does that. You are kicked off the podcast.
Oh, shush.
Not allowed to listen to the podcast.
All right, what is the stupid song?
I just need a moment to
call myself. No, you don't. What's the stupid song?
I'm really upset by what you just said. Take these broken wings.
Oh, God, that's an awful song.
And learn to fly again.
All right.
Learn
to live so free.
Live so free. Yeah. That's a great song.
No, it's not.
I know everything about that song, except all the words.
Late 80s started to have really crappy songs.
Yeah. No, that was a great song.
No, that's not a great song.
You know,
of course, I don't like ballads, so every time there's a ballad, I say it's a bad song.
I will admit, a lot of the ballads and
stuff.
I will admit that I think I started liking more when you play them. Like, funny thing, that video game Grand Theft Auto, where you could turn on the 80s station.
Oh, and it was all...
It really made songs from the 80s sound so much cooler. They were much more fun, like when you're shooting
guys. When do you play Grand Theft Auto?
I don't anymore, but I used to. Oh. The ones that came out in the... I don't know, 10 years ago or whatever.
Okay.
And they would have an 80s channel and you could play
all these crazy
songs. Broken Wings while murdering people, and it just makes it better in a song.
Okay.
Like you now remember it instead of remembering it as
you're
a kid.
You're a psychopath.
I don't want to really murder anyone, but it's fun to murder them in a video game. Wednesday, December 18th, 1985, The Color Purple came out.
Yes, and it jointly holds the record with The Turning Point in 1977 for the film with most Oscar nominations without a single win,
was 11. It's because of racism, probably, right?
Maybe.
This is Whoopi Goldberg's first film.
Yes.
Oprah Winfrey's first film, but Whoopi Goldberg's first feature film.
Yes.
But Oprah Winfrey went to a fat farm. She was at a fat farm trying to lose weight. When she learned she got the role. So she had to leave immediately because she needed to stay chubby.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
She was good in that. You said you never saw it, but she was good in it.
Yeah, I didn't. I haven't.
Oprah's really good in it.
I don't know why. I don't know. I know Steven Spielberg said he felt insecure about being the director of this film.
Right.
But Quincy Jones... Well, he felt insecure because, you know...
Right.
What does he know about racism in the South and... he thinks it should be directed by somebody of color, but Quincy Jones, somebody who have faced the struggles, and Quincy Jones said something about, no, did you have to be an alien to direct E.T.? No,
yeah.
It's fine, you know, whatever kind of thing. So that's interesting. Friday, December 20th, 1985, Out of Africa.
That's right. And I have nothing for that.
You don't have anything for that?
No, because I've never seen it.
I haven't either. And can't see
all
it.
The
it's
trivia,
not available anywhere.
All the trivia is about the... It's based on a true person's life, and all the trivia is about that.
It's about that person, but we don't know?
Don't know... Yeah, it's like a writer or somebody, and I don't know any of the context.
We know it's got Meryl Streep, right?
Yeah.
Meryl Streep and...
I don't know who.
Jeffrey Tambor?
Maybe. No.
No.
You made that up.
Wouldn't that be great? Although I think he's a sexual assault guy now, too.
Oh, is he?
I think
not Jeffrey Tambor.
Yeah, he did
something wrong.
Yeah, and he even, I mean, you're supposed to think he's great because he plays a transgender person, but
right.
I guess he was sexually harassing everyone.
I think
everyone.
Quit breaking my heart, men.
We need to just take a break from all men for a while.
That's
just have all women in charge and in media just for a while.
Something.
And then you can be let back in as a man once you've
proven that you're not a weirdo.
Stop doing stuff with your wiener. Out of Africa. No, it is available to pay for, but I don't like paying for movies.
I don't think it's that good.
But it won an Oscar. I think it won Best Picture.
Yeah, I think it might have.
Or something. Yeah, it won Best Picture because it was on my list of movies I was supposed to watch, but I haven't been able to see it.
Yeah.
I can't find it for free. December 21st, 1985. A new number one song takes over the Billboard charts by Lionel Richie.
Yeah.
And since you're a huge Richie fan.
Since I'm a huge Lionel Richie fan. Is it Hello?
No.
Is it Dancing on the Ceiling, or we already do that one? They all are the same.
It's not Dancing on the Ceiling. It's a very
Is it Truly, Truly in Love with You,
That's
girl.
Not that either.
Oh.
That was last year, I think.
Oh, it was.
The previous year. Say you,
oh.
say me.
See, my point is constantly proven that Lionel Richie sucks.
That's a great song.
No, it's not.
You just hate his mustache.
No, I hate his music.
I feel like you don't respect the mustache, is
no.
what I think.
You're not wearing your Lionel Richie shirt anymore.
No,
I changed
it.
Beginning of the episode, you were.
Well, I like to change. I have like to
you
do
change
costume
your, change
changes.
Up your shirt.
Yeah, I do.
Now you're wearing a Golden Girls shirt.
I do like, yeah.
There's something wrong with you.
Yeah, there's something wrong with me. I do costume changes in the podcast.
That's right.
You do. What was the award
like
ceremony where it's like Beyonce? How many costume changes does Beyonce
and so
do?
You got to do some too.
Yeah, do costume
That's
changes.
Right.
I mean, it's for our fans.
That's right.
Saturday, December 21st, the same day that Lionel Richie takes over the top spot.
Yes.
Edward Johnson
yeah.
programmed his computer to call Jerry Falwell's toll-free number every 30 seconds and then hang up.
Why?
In total, he charged over $500,000 in phone bills to Falwell's organization by tying
Sweet.
Up the lines. He said he launched the campaign after seeing an April 7th broadcast in which TV preacher Jimmy Swaggart talked about acquired immune deficiency syndrome and homosexuals.
Oh, I bet it was awful what he said.
And he said earlier he had been angered when his mother contributed to these television evangelists.
Because they're all shysters.
She's easily taken in by these people. She almost gave the family farm away to these guys.
God, they were awful.
Said,
they took so much money from people.
In 1985, to be able to program your computer to do that,
yeah,
not many people could do that.
He must have been a genius.
Yeah, he was.
That's
good
sweet.
For him.
Yeah, good for him.
Sunday, December 22nd, 1985.
Yeah.
Madonna takes over the number one chart with
her
most known song by Madonna.
Material Girl?
No.
Oh.
A little more known than that, right?
Like a Virgin?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like a surgeon, a virgin.
Yeah.
Surgeon was Weird Al's version, but yep.
In that video where she's rolling around in her wedding dress.
It was written by Billy Steinberg and Tom Kelly. The mm-hmm. idea for the song originated when Steinberg was living in his father's vineyards in the Coachella Valley and driving a red pickup truck one day. In an interview with the Los Angeles Times, he explained that the song was not written for Madonna or any female singer, but was inspired by his personal experiences. At this time, Steinberg had just come out of an emotionally challenging relationship, and he had met someone new. That inspired the lyrics for Like a Virgin.
I can't imagine a man singing that.
Difficult situation.
I think
that
would be a total joke if a man sang
I know.
That.
When I read that, I can't believe he wrote that. Yeah.
And he didn't say it was for a woman to sing.
Yeah, when he took the song to Kelly, they decided that it would be a sensitive ballad. However, they could not decide how the word virgin would fit in. And he said, I wasn't just trying to get that racy word virgin in a lyric. I was saying that I may not really be a virgin, but I've been battered romantically and emotionally like many people. But I'm starting a new relationship.
God,
it just feels so good.
What a douche.
It's healing all the wounds and making me feel
oh
like I've never
God.
Done this before because
oh,
it's so
man.
Much deeper and more profound than anything I've ever felt.
You guys said this to a reporter?
Yeah, and he probably said that to a woman in that relationship, and
she was probably
she
like
that?
She
like,
probably got rid of him right then
yeah,
and there.
What
like
Jay, what are you talking about?
I know.
Tuesday, December 24th. That's Christmas Eve.
Yes.
Abraham Lincoln on that day
was shot.
No. Abraham Lincoln was dead for years.
I know.
But this is when his last descendant died.
Oh.
A great grandson, Robert Todd Lincoln Beckwith, died on December 24th, 1985. When there are now no more Lincoln relatives.
Okay. Should I do my Christmas?
I have one thing on Christmas.
You do?
Yeah, do your Christmas
okay.
list. But this is, actually, why don't you go ahead and start, because
okay.
my thing might be part of your thing, because mine's a toy.
Okay, that's so the toys,
yes.
now that we're at Christmas in 1985.
Christmas
popular
85.
Toys, and I need to do an apology and a correction from last time. The CNC
what?
Was invented in 1965, so we were correct.
So we were right about
it. I don't know why it was on that list. Maybe they came out with like a new
Maybe
version.
It was a new kind or something.
Yeah, because I knew that we both were like, yeah, we played with that when we were
Thank
kids.
You for correcting that.
So anyway, the Transformers Autobot Radio Communicator. Transformers more than meets the eye. This Autobot transforms into a radio communicator. So it looks like a radio.
Yeah.
And then it can play tapes, I think.
Oh,
and
yeah.
then it turns into a transformer. Then
Oh, wait a minute. What was it called?
Transformers Autobot Radio Communicator.
Oh, because there was a transformer that turned into a boombox.
It was kind of like that. It was smaller. That was red.
Oh, this one was orange and yellow, I think.
Okay, so it must have been different. Then Barbie's home and office. Portable case opens up to a beautiful bedroom on one side, office on the other for Barbie.
What does she do in her office?
She twiddles.
That's it? She doesn't
No, do she's taxes. Got lots of... She's probably an accountant.
She should be an accountant.
Yeah, she's been everything.
You know, I've never once...
Barbie has been...
a lot of things.
The president of the United States.
Well, she has.
Astronaut.
Well, I'm proud of her.
Yeah,
then.
She's been. All
I know
kinds
a lot of people
things.
Think of her just being a bimbo, but you
and
know,
her running mate was a woman. Was another Barbie that was a girl.
Well, she was super hot, and I will say that's typical of accounting to me. I've never met somebody in an accounting department that isn't super hot and beautiful.
You haven't been around accounting departments much.
Oh though. No, we have an accounting department, and actually, most of the accounting department where I work, they listen. So I will say they are very,
say very attractive
people. They are. I mean, you think you don't know you're walking in an accounting department. You walk into the accounting department where I work, and you think you've just walked into a modeling agency, and it's just a bunch of models.
No, you're playing it on a little bit.
They're all beautiful people.
All right, the next thing is the bed bugs game. Bugs are in the bed. This frantic chase and capture game called Bed Bugs is zany and fun.
That's disgusting.
Take the giant bug tongs and capture the bugs from the bed, but make sure they're the right color. So that was like,
you know,
it was like a Hungry Hippos type game where the thing like vibrated and the little plastic bugs would jump all around and you had tongs and you had to pick the bugs off of
it. There are super poor people
that have real
that are
bed
laying
bugs.
There with real bed bugs saying, rich people are amusing themselves by pretending they're
that.
In our house playing with our bed bugs.
Then there was Fisher-Price Kodak camera. And this camera from Fisher-Price and Kodak is made for children. It has specially designed film advance and shutter controls that are extra large for use with small fingers.
Boom.
Level pictures are a snap thanks to the bright red indicator. It has soft cushioned end caps, a breakaway neck strap, impact-resistant film door, and built-in lens cover. And it had, like, you remember those big flash bulbs that were like in a... They were like, there'd be like eight of them, little squares. It came with that you'd put on it. Like, it was a real,
camera.
And I never remember that
one
at
either.
All.
I remember my grandma always had those flashbulb things.
There's GoBot Puzzler Set. This Puzzler Set turns into six separate GoBots when you maneuver the parts.
GoBots. Knockoff of Transformers.
Rainbow Bright Color Kids. The Color Kids are here to help Rainbow Bright spread the cheer. 9-inch soft sculptured fabric dolls have vinyl faces and yarn hair. Each has color sprite to match. Choose from Rainbow Bright, Lala Orange, Buddy Blue, Canary Yellow, Shy Violet, Red Butler, and Patio Green.
I remember Rainbow Bright. I remember they had a Rainbow Bright cereal that I always wanted, but I was always afraid that...
You were afraid you'd be...
I couldn't get it.
Because it's girls.
I couldn't ask it because I thought my mom wouldn't get it, but it looked so delicious.
Then there was a robot named Verbo.
Verbo.
And is the remote control voice activated robot. Through his wireless remote microphone, you could order him to move forward and backward, turn right or left, and pick up lightweight things. Could even tell him when to smile. And it kind of looked like that.
Smile, bitch.
Remember Alfie robot?
Yeah, I remember
it kind of looked like
we
that.
Had Alfie.
And he had like a pixelated face. So it would smile. Then there was a Get In Shape Girl Workout Plus. And
Get
I remember
in shape
this.
Girl.
Workout Plus is an ideal for fashion conscious little lady. Includes two lightweight dumbbells, Terry headband, and two leg warmers. So it was just a dumbbell, some leg warmers, and a headband. And that's what
it
was.
They probably made so much money.
And they probably did. And I remember it was so. I mean, talk about the anorexic 80s.
We need to come up with stupid.
You know,
yeah, making people fat shame.
Making
fat shame children.
Yep.
Fat shame them early.
And then the last one was Wuzzles. Wuzzles are fantasy characters that combine the best features of two different animals.
I remember these.
They live in the magical land of Wuzz, a place where all things are possible. Soft and cuddly, they'll capture the heart of any child.
Wuzzles.
They have a surface washable acrylic cover. Each comes with an exciting storybook so children can join them in their many adventures. Choose from Bumble Lion, Butter Bear, Eleru, Hippopotamus, Moosel, or Rhino Key. So,
yeah.
And they were kind of
Rhino
like,
and a monkey. Yeah, I remember those. Yeah. I think Steve Bishop also had Wuzzles.
Wuzzles.
He was a Wuzzle fan. And that's all your toys?
Those are my toys.
Because I have a toy.
Okay.
Mattel released an action figure of, remember you talked about the He-Man figures?
Yes.
And then later they made more He-Man, like different secondary characters. They released an action figure of Stinkor, who was an anthropomorphic skunk supervillain of the He-Man universe.
Oh, okay.
In 1985, patchouli oil was added to the molds to recreate the character's unpleasant superpower. So he really stunk. He had patchouli on him. And I looked a lot of this up because we had Stinkor.
You did?
And famously, we lost him in a big sand pile at the lake.
Yeah.
Where there was a big giant sand pile. We'd play in the sand all the time.
And you got him.
We would bury guys and we would like, you know, you try to find, it's like hide the characters and try to find them.
And you could never find
him.
We
never found Stinkor. Like, we never found him.
Somebody did someday, maybe.
I don't think so. I think he's still in that sand. But I want to go up there someday and see if we can find Stinkor.
Dig him
up. But People have said that they've dug out their toys from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Now it's how many years has it been? 40 years ago?
Yeah.
35, and whatever.
Stinkor still smells.
Stinkor still smells like patchouli. Like he's still got a stink. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
Yeah. That's a weird thing. And he would look exactly like Merman, except he was not blue, he was black.
Okay.
Thursday, December 26th, the day after Christmas.
I've got two things for that.
Oh, you do have something. Okay, two things, yeah.
What do you got?
The Colbys were on TV. It was a spinoff of Dynasty.
Dynasty, I remember that.
Blake Fallon and Little Blake are reunited on this episode.
Okay.
And Hutch breaks off his relationship with Constance after learning about her wealth from Monica.
Their names. Names kill me on the Dynasty.
Miles offers Fallon an annulment.
Fallon, Blake, and Miles.
And catches his father confessing his love for Francesca.
God.
Did you know that Charlton Heston and Ricardo Montalban were on that?
No.
I didn't know they were on that. Also on ABC was Shadow Chasers.
Don't remember that.
A sleazy scandal sheet reporter Benny and stiff British college professor Jonathan team up to investigate UFO sightings.
Okay. Don't remember that.
And vampires and time travelers and ghosts and other paranormal things. Yeah, I don't remember ever hearing about that.
Yeah.
What do you have?
I have first the airplane celebrity death. No, wait. Never
December
mind.
December
26th. The 26th. Okay. This December 26th, I have a kind of a little mini story. About a man named Whitley Strieber.
So something happened to Whitley Strieber the same night that the Colbys was on?
Yes. So Whitley Strieber was a screenwriter, and he wrote Wolfen. Remember that movie? And The Hunger?
Nope.
They're kind of like horror movies. He wrote those. And he was vacationing with his wife and son over the Christmas holidays in 1985. He claims that at 11 o'clock p.m. on December 26th, he was abducted by aliens.
Ooh.
And it's an accepted fact in the UFO community that very few scientists will entertain the idea that UFOs are real. It's even rarer that an educated professional person would delve into the dark, puzzling world of alien abductions. Author Whitley Strieber is one of those rare individuals. His book, Communion, is a must-read for anyone interested in the subject. He is an abductee himself, and his abduction is one of the most bizarre on record.
What? I'm going to read that.
He's one of the most important figures in alien research. So his strange abduction would take place in an isolated cabin in the northern part of New York State. The lonely setting of the cabin caused him to have concerns for this family's safety, and he had only recently had a cutting-edge security system installed. He was
cutting edge of 1985.
Right. And he was the last person in the world to believe aliens were real, according to him, before this happened.
Oh, he was the last person. You know, he would like, never believe.
Yeah. Yeah. So he had activated his security system at about 11 p.m. on December 26th, and his family began to retire for the evening. A few hours later, he heard a strange sound, which woke him from sleep. Yeah. It was like a whooshing sound, he said. So, thinking that he might have a burglar who had set off the alarm system, he went to check it out. As he did, he was shocked to see a creature standing in his bedroom that was
bleep, blur, bleep.
3 feet tall, gray alien with big eyes and a small mouth. It saw him and it ran downstairs.
Classic gray.
The next thing Strieber knew, he was sitting in a woods a few hundred yards away that encircled his cabin. He was out in the woods, and
he was teleported.
It was the morning. He was at a loss to explain what had happened and how he had gotten from the bedroom to the woods. His memories were lost.
Wiped the memories.
He eventually sought the help of Dr. Donald F. Klein.
Was there anything wrong with his anus? Anal probes?
I don't know. We'll wait and see.
Oh.
Klein would perform regressive hypnosis on Strieber in an attempt to recover the lost time. The sessions would be helpful and enable him to recover many of the details of what really happened on the night of December 26th.
Oh my gosh, happened? What really happened? I can't wait.
Strieber recalls being floated from his bedroom to a UFO, which was waiting somewhere above the thick woods. He would see several different types of alien beings on the ship. One was a little robot type. Another was a short, stocky humanoid.
Oh, George Costanza.
The third type was very thin and frail with haunting black slanted eyes, and the last had smaller button-type eyes.
So like Manute Bol, and then...
he would undergo numerous medical procedures on the UFO. They were communicating with him somehow. He was in an operating theater, and a metallic box was brought out that they communicated was going to go in his brain.
Wow.
So one of the harrowing procedures was the insertion of a long needle directly into his brain. Wow. The aliens also inserted a tool in his rectum. There you go for that.
Rectum.
And took a blood sample from his finger.
Always rectum action.
That's right. Because many of the details of his alleged abduction were so bizarre, Dr. Klein diagnosed Stryber as having temporal lobe epilepsy. One of the most common effects of the condition is the onset of hallucinations.
Hmm.
So temporal lobe epilepsy can be explained this way. The features of seizures beginning in the temporal lobe can be extremely varied, but certain patterns are common. There may be a mixture of different feelings, emotions, thoughts, and experiences, which may be familiar or completely foreign. In others, the person may feel as if everything, including home and family, appears strange. Hallucinations of voices, music, people, smells, or tastes may occur.
Hmm. Sounds to me like it's just alien. That's what happens when there's an alien. That's a diagnosis they give, a fake diagnosis.
That Stryber did not accept Dr. Klein's diagnosis and believed that all of the events he recalled in regressive hypnosis really happened.
Yep.
He would form a support group for adoptees and write extensively on the subject. He went to a podiatrist named Roger Lear, who was a friend of his, and he said that he had an implant. He claimed that there was something implanted in his ear, and so.
And the podiatrist said, "I can't help you. I only do with feet. I can clip your toenails."
According to them, the podiatrist found the implant in his ear, and it was
even though it wasn't a foot.
Yes. And that the implant was giving off an FM signal inside of his body.
Wow.
They dug it out, and it was made of a meteoric iron. And according to them, according to that doctor, when he went to retrieve it, like it moved, it burrowed deeper into the ear. They retrieved a piece of it. Dr. Lear would go on to remove 16 different implants from people claiming alien abduction.
Boom.
The implants are covered in protein strings that are alive and somehow woven into the metal.
Jeez.
They're enmeshed in flesh inside of the muscle. So it's like they're covered in like the skin, but it's inside the muscle.
Yeah.
And you can't have, naturally, you wouldn't have anything with skin on it inside your muscle.
Yep, it definitely, we're all controlled by aliens. I think we're all controlled by squid.
So, as the years progressed, Stryber claims he would be constantly abducted. He didn't tell his wife at first because he thought he'd been raped and his brain was processing it in a weird way.
Yeah.
He finally told his wife and she said she experienced the same thing. He felt he needed to make peace with
She also was abducted?
Yeah. And then he felt he needed to make peace with the visitors, as he called them. So they started to commune with the visitors. And he now sort of supports these visitors coming.
Yeah, and you become friends with them. Hey, buddy, where's Phil?
And
Phil's not here this time.
Yeah, he has a website called Unknown Country that he maintains.
Still?
Yeah.
Unknown Country? Did you check it out?
No, I didn't check it out.
Holy cow!
But that's the story of Whitley Stryber's strange alien abduction.
That's changed my life. I'm gonna What's it called? Unknown what?
Unknown Country.
Unknown Country. I'm gonna look at that up, and then we'll report back.
You'll look at that up.
I'm gonna look at that up. Yeah, I'm gonna definitely look that up. I believe that sounds more believable than all the other stuff you've ever said. Serial killers.
Everything. Okay.
And then you have Thursday, December 31st, New Year's Eve.
An airplane celebrity death.
Yeah.
Ricky Nelson.
Of the band Nelson, the 80s band Nelson.
So on December 26th, Nelson and the band left for a three-stop tour of the southern United States.
Now, Nelson and Gunner, that's their names, right?
Those are the Nelson twins. Those are the kids.
Oh, those are Ricky Nelson's kids?
Yeah. Those are Ricky Nelson's kids.
Oh, the Nelson twins. I didn't realize they had a famous father.
Yeah. So, following shows in Orlando, Florida, and Gunnersville, Alabama, Nelson and the band members...
Gunnersville. That's why they named him Gunner.
...took off from Gunnersville for a New Year's Eve extravaganza in Dallas, Texas. The plane crash landed northeast of Dallas in DeKalb, Texas, in a cow pasture less than 2 miles from a landing strip at approximately 5:14 p.m. on December 31st, 1985, hitting trees on its way down. 7 of the 9 occupants were killed.
Oh, man. Including Ricky Nelson.
Including Ricky Nelson.
Man, poor guy.
That's right.
And then the Nelson twins.
And then the Nelson twins. So that was 1985.
That was 1985 in a nutshell. And so that's part
Large
two.
Large nutshell.
That was part two of 1985,
that's
which
right.
Thank all you
Yes, thank you, everybody people. Who's listening. Tell a friend.
Yeah, we really didn't think anybody would be listening. When there are some people, there's not a ton, but there's some.
We'll get there.
We're entertaining.
This is only the 20th episode, or
that's true.
We just went over it, and I don't remember.
Yeah, we're only the 18th,
or 19th, or something like that.
19th,
and
but we'll get there. I mean, word will spread, and this is an interesting like format.
That's right.
Hopefully nobody just steals this format. It's two famous people don't steal this format and just do it themselves.
That's right.
Just steal our research.
But thank you. Follow us on Twitter at
History for Jerks. Yeah, and I got to thank Matt Truman again.
That's right.
His music is awesome. I just found another album of his called Ice Cream Novelties. It's a new album he's got. It's not new. It came out in 2017, but it's good.
Yeah.
He's got a bunch of albums on there. Check him out.
Yes.
It's on Bandcamp. Website, check that out,
and check us out on Twitter and Facebook at History for Jerks.
I just Instagrammed his new album, so check out our Instagram
at History for Jerks, right?
I think
and
that's it.
American same. Timelines and Facebook.
American Timelines
and podcast. Tell a friend and rate and review
us
on iTunes.
More, give us 5 stars on iTunes, even if you hate us.
That's right. Just give us 5 stars and then say
somebody gave us 1 star. Somebody hates us and gave us 1 star, so we need more 5 stars.
That's right. And if you know us, then you're a dick if you haven't rated us.
Yeah, and if you know us and aren't listening. You aren't hearing this.
No, you aren't hearing this. Yeah. But if you know us, you're listening, and you haven't rate and review us, then you're a dick.
On. Well, you're not a dick. You've just been lazy.
Get off your asshole.
It doesn't take that long. Brandon Wilhelm, I'm talking to you.
Get off your butthole.
Brandon Wilhelm is
a
beautiful man.
Brandon.
Oh, and there's a correction apology he gave me. Remember several episodes back in the season 1, we found out how expensive that Tom Cruise video was.
Oh,
It was like $30. I was like, oh, my God, they're all, or $100 or something.
Yeah.
I was like, $100? He said that was... That's how much they were for video stores to buy them. Because video stores would get new videos first, and they'd be like $90, $100. And then when they open to the public, they're like $20.
Oh, that's still a lot of money he spent on that.
He did.
He can't justify it.
He
to
did
us.
Still spend a lot of money. But now he spends all his money on
beer,
IPAs, and he's the Green Lady.
Yep.
So shout out to the Green Lady. Mention in a podcast. If you're a regular of Green Lady in Chicago, well, listen to our podcast and subscribe and like and give us 5 stars. And the owner is a wonderful lady that gets delicious beers. They had one called Gummy Vortex that I enjoyed there. It was delicious.
All right.
I love you.
Right.
I love all of you.
Yep. It's time to get out of here, Chuck Berry.
Yes. I love the accounting department. I love everyone. Get out of here, Chuck Berry.
Get out.